Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. Very nice to have you with us, and thrilled to have you. Hopefully, you had a lovely weekend, or as lovely as weekends can be, and that you are you're even well rested. Wouldn't that be nice? You're ready for the week ahead. It will be a busy news week. We're going to get a new president this week, so we'll talk about all of that this morning. Let me introduce the group to you, and we'll get started. As always, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit somber about Martin Luther King Day. What a great hero we Americans have had. I'm thinking about him, and I'm thinking about his premature ending of his life and of the racism that exists in this country. It's really quite terrible. But in any case, I'm all right. I've been up for 7 hours and took my walk and did my thing.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you are here. Good morning to you. Let's go to political consultant Libby Post, who's here. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm fine. I'm looking forward to a wonderful week.
Yes.
With the change in presidency. I feel like we can all start breathing again at 12:01 on Wednesday.
Your breathing may vary, but yes, absolutely.
I hope you're right. This stinker, you never know what he's going to do in his last hours in office. I mean, Trump, of course.
Well, he's going to pardon a whole bunch of felons who, paid to get pardoned, but that's another story for later on.
Jennifer Burns is here, UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson, is here. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
So nice to have you aboard. We also welcome. Yes, good to have you. We're always also thrilled to have Fran Berman with us, the Edward Hamilton Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at RPI, faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Good morning, Fran Berman. How are you?
Good morning. Happy Martin Luther King Day. Happy Inauguration Week. And science is back. I can't tell you how excited I am.
we take our victories where we can get them. But yes, science is back. Isn't that lovely?
Science is back.
Well, we'll talk about that this morning as well. We welcome what you have to say, what you have to think. Panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, let's get started and start talking about what's making news this morning. Of course, the COVID and coronavirus, the deaths now are over. 400,000 people have died in this country. And the reason for some looking back here is that we are exactly 1 year from the identification of the first case. And so it gives us an opportunity to look back a little bit and see what has happened over the year. The most depressing part of it being that we are really at the peak and at the worst, that nothing has gotten better. It has only gotten progressively worse. So as the if the White House declined to pursue a unified national strategy, governors faced off against lobbyists, health experts, and a restless public consumed by misinformation. And here we are. It is still very difficult for many people. The governor of New York State keeps on saying that, the weapon to win the war is the vaccine. And yet it is difficult to get the vaccine. Nearly 1 year since the coronavirus case in the United States was announced north of Seattle on January 21st, 2020, the full extent of the nation's failures has come into clear view. The country is hurtling toward 400,000 total deaths. Sadly, there are expectations that by the end of the week, we could be at 500,000 cases. Hospitalizations and deaths have reached record highs as the nation endures its darkest chapter of the pandemic yet. The situation turned dire just as the Trump administration in its final days begins to see the fruits of perhaps its biggest coronavirus success, the Operation Warp Speed vaccine program. But already a lack of federal coordination in distributing doses has emerged as a troubling roadblock. The incoming president, Joseph Biden, has said he will reassert a federal strategy to bring the virus under control, including a call for everyone to wear masks over the next 100 days and a coordinated plan to widen the delivery of vaccines. "We will manage the hell out of this operation," Mr. Biden said over the weekend. "Our administration will lead with science and scientists." So a nod to what Fran was saying just a moment ago. Alan.
Well, you know, congratulations, Fran. Fran is, of course, the scientist among us. And it's great, Fran, that you acknowledge that. And also Sarah. Because Sarah's been fighting the good fight on immigration, and now we have Biden talking about, the first day reversing some of the most onerous of the anti-immigrant credo that he has. So, it is really it's a good day, and I'm just praying for Biden. I'm sure that he'll do well. And I want him to stay safe. That's all I got to say about that. And I got a lot to hear from my colleagues, so let's leave it at that.
So, Fran, just on that sentence of "we will manage the hell out of this operation, our administration will lead with science and scientists." So fundamentally, what changes with a declaration like that?
Yeah, and this reminds me of my my favorite line from The Martian, and I don't know if I can say all the words on the air. It's like he's gonna science the S out of this.
Yes.
You can figure out
yeah.
what S is, and I love that because that's what we're gonna do. Okay, do you want the bad news or the good news first?
Well, we'll take both, but typically we've been taught that we want the bad news first.
Yeah, always okay. give the bad news.
Okay, well,
always give okay, the bad news first.
Welcome to, you know, our 2020 reality. And, you know, the bad news is there's a bunch of stuff working against, you know, a quick and satisfying, you know, end right now. You know, not the least of which is Trump's missteps. You know, he rushed to reopen. He sidelined science, you know, at every possible instance. You know, there's a bunch of people who quit because they were just, you know, tired of being harassed and all of that. People were discouraged against doing regular public health things. They were politicized, wearing masks or social distancing or getting together when things were really bad. So there's a lot of sort of bad stuff that Trump did. There's some bad stuff that, you know, is sort of a consequence of that. We all have pandemic fatigue. We couldn't or we did against advice get together at Thanksgiving, at Christmas, you know, winter. The medical profession is exhausted. There's new strains and they're more contagious, although the outcomes are not currently known to be more severe. So all of that is kind of bad news. But the good news is that Biden really intends to have a federal plan. We have supply chain problems. Even when there's enough vaccine, we don't know how to get it to the people in a reasonable way. And for those of you who, you know, tried to navigate the system in New York, I have, and it's not easy. And, you know, it exacerbates the digital divide, all that kinds of stuff. Biden has clearer messaging. He has help from science. I actually really feel hopeful that they are going to, you know, get things organized and things will go better. That doesn't mean necessarily super fast, but that things will go better. And towards the last half of this year, you know, we're going to see a really different environment that we see now.
Libby Post.
Well, I'm looking forward to having a president who values science. I mean, you know, he's making the science advisor a cabinet level position now, and you know, we'll be dealing with somebody, or we'll have someone, two people, both Biden and Harris, who recognize the importance of impartial scientific research to manage crises and healthcare crises in particular. And you know, I've had this thing, and it is not pretty. It just isn't. And anybody, I mean, I doubt anybody who's listening to us thinks we don't have to wear masks, but you never know. I mean, you don't want this. You do not want COVID. You don't want this as part of your life. You know, I'm speaking from experience. Thankfully, you know, we never ended up in the hospital or anything like that, but it's not been fun. And, you know, we need a, you know, as I read these articles this morning, I just thought to myself, my God, Trump is responsible for almost 400,000 deaths. He's responsible for the fact that we don't have a coordinated effort. He's responsible for the fact that county health officials got death threats. I mean, the incompetence of this administration, and this is not something we already don't know, but still, as we're making this transition from Trump to Biden, it's becoming so fundamentally clear and basic how important science is to our daily lives, critical thinking is to our daily lives, and the fact that finally we're going to have a coordinated federal effort. That's the only way this will work, is a coordinated federal effort. Trump let each state do their own thing, and we saw how well that did or didn't work. And now, I mean, we could have a 500,000 deaths by the, you know, by the end of the week or by the end of the month. I mean, it's just, it's astounding that this is what we're looking at. But I'm feeling hopeful with the new administration.
You know, Libby, you just said something which I've been thinking again and again, and that is that Trump from, I said in my morning commentary, but that Trump is responsible for much of what has happened to the American people. You know, we have 400,000.
It's all at his feet, Alan, all of it.
When you take a look at this SOB miscreant said that we weren't going to have this in the United States. He never talks about it. He never talks about his responsibility. He took off his mask symbolically. He doesn't want anybody wearing a mask around him. Think about what that has meant and how many people are dead because of him, and you made the point, and I very much respect.
Jennifer Burns.
You know, for me, it all does fall on Trump. I mean, that's the last stop, really, right? He's the commander-in-chief of all of these things. But, you know, I'm always stuck on how he really weaponized the handling of it. Right. So he was able to play governors against other governors and still pit the Democrats against the Republicans by holding the purse strings of the money. Right. Dangling who would get it and who wouldn't if they didn't follow opening policies that his administration wanted. So there's more to just the mishandling of, oh, it's, you know, his verbosity over and over and over again about how it's going to disappear and all of that. It's also that behind the scenes weaponizing, using money attached to who can get a vaccine, when they'll get it, if they'll get relief in other ways. That's the part I also find incredibly disturbing.
It is disturbing. And of course, as we've been discussing this morning, the long-term effects of not just the coronavirus response, but of so many different issues of what has to be done over the next days, months, years is fairly staggering. Sarah Rogerson, you know, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to say one more thing. And Joe, you know that this guy, Trump, has a thing about executing people before he leaves office, killing them, giving them whatever it is that takes their lives away. Put one of those people up against, as Libby has said so profoundly, 400,000 Americans that this guy has helped to kill. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Sarah.
So I'm thinking, I got the vaccination at UAlbany as a 1B category individual on Saturday, and it was such a smooth, well-run, terrific operation. And I sat, you have to sit in observation for 20 to 30 minutes afterwards. And I was just looking around and thinking, If we could, you know, the states are ready. If the federal supply was there, and it should be, it should have been by now. The reserves should be shipped out. We shouldn't be 50,000 short this week in the state of New York. These are things that should be happening now. And when you think about the racial disparity in terms of not just who's suffering from this disease, but also who is now more reluctant to access the vaccine, in part because of what we saw at the Capitol. If there are white nationalists who have enabled this president and who he has enabled, and you're relying on that same leadership to inject something into your veins, you know, like that, that's a terrifying thought for a lot of Americans who have been historically experimented upon using their bodies. And there were just so many thoughts that I had sitting there. I kind of wanted to sit there for like another hour and write something about it. But mostly I was just overcome with two feelings, and that's relief and grief at the same time.
And how did you,
Sarah, what was your experience navigating the website? I mean, I'm a computer scientist, and I navigated that website, and you know, I didn't find it particularly easy, and I just worried that people who are not used to, you know, messing around with their computer or changing their browser because one browser doesn't work. I mean, I really worried about that.
We have about 45 seconds, but go ahead.
And think about all the old people who don't even have a computer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think we all have to help each other is the short answer to that. But I had a fairly easy experience, but there were like three law professors talking, you know, replying on a reply all chain, figuring out how to sign up. So that's a privilege that lots of folks don't have.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a break here and pause. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. We just ask that you keep your letters short and to the point, and that way we can get in as many as we possibly can. panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson make up our group this morning. We will continue our conversation on the Roundtable panel after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you all with us. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson. And of course, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We got this letter from Joshua who says, look, no one has a lower opinion of Trump than I, but it's just irresponsible to say that Trump is responsible for 400,000 deaths and call for more critical thinking in the same sentence. Comments, panel.
Oh, come on. You know, he is responsible because of his inability to respond to this crisis. If he believed in science, if he wore a mask, if he set an example, if he told his minions to do what was right in terms of wearing masks and socially distance, we wouldn't be in the position we're in.
He said day one it wasn't coming to the United States.
One That's case it'll go away. Yeah.
One
all
case
you need to do is read. Right. All you need to do is read Bob Woodward's latest book.
Yeah,
and it's all laid out there.
I mean, I know there are those people who believe up is down and down is up and black is white and white is black and all the rest of it, and will never be convinced. But if you look at the straight evidence here, the guy is really responsible for much of the death that occurred in this country.
I think the letter is interesting. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, rhetorically speaking... Oh, go ahead.
Sarah,
go on.
I love the traffic cop part of my job. Go, Sarah, and then we'll go to Fran. Go ahead.
Well, rhetorically speaking, you know, if the Republicans' rallying call to elect Trump over Hillary was because of Benghazi, which was a much more detached and spurious claim, you know, I just want to hold those two side by side and note that there is a direct connection between Trump and the deaths that have occurred, including failures, massive failures in leadership.
Now, Fran.
Sorry about that, Sarah.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think the letter is interesting because, you know, in a sense, you know, Trump is not supremely powerful unless, you know, others, you know, are on the boat with him, give him the power. And I do think that the responsibility is shared with, you know, all of those who said, sure, whatever you say. You know, that includes folks in the Senate and folks in the House. You know, that includes folks in the states. That includes, you know, everyone who, you know, said these are the marching orders and I'm going to march, whether it makes sense or not, whether it's realistic or not, whether it's prudent or not. And there are a lot of people in that boat. So, you know, in some sense, you know, I think that is it John who wrote the letter? I think John has, you know, a good point.
Well, and can we add in here, though, the amount of wasted time? Because the Obama administration had created sort of a playbook for pandemics.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump's administration threw that out and spent time, it seems, if you read through it, copying, cutting, and pasting, revamping it, not trusting on science for it. And that right there, of course, is also a part of the problem, changing the administrative way of handling it because he has a vendetta against the Obama administration. And we have to be able to admit that at this point.
Yeah.
And let's not forget that it's been documented that they thought that the virus was really just going to impact black and brown people, and so big deal was their response to that.
Well, and that goes back to, you know, dismantling everything that the black president put into mm-hmm. place.
Right.
Right.
We got this from Connor writes, Trump is tragically the logical extension ad absurd absurdum of the trajectory. Oh, speaking is going to be fun today. Of the trajectory of the right wing and Republican Party since Reagan quipped about the terror of government trying to help. The horrors we witness now are like a cigarette smoldering in a couch for hours until someone opens a window or door. The oxygen feeds the fire and the house is suddenly in flames. We've been headed for this for some time.
You know, I'm glad that Joe Biden is a moderate president, because there is a coalition of Americans who see the absurdity of the Trump presidency now, and they came over. The middle came over, and some Republicans, but the middle came over. I just don't want to see the Democrats blow it right now and start to fight in a way that mm-hmm. will destroy the coalition. It would be terrible, and I know that we're capable of seeing this.
that's in the Democratic DNA,
well,
right?
And doesn't that attach right to it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day? His
yep.
1963, when he was jailed in Birmingham, his letter from the Birmingham jail called out moderates, right? Explaining to them the difference between just laws and unjust laws, and also that if you are a moderate, though, you are part of the problem. You are not pushing hard enough for equality when it comes to economics, when it comes to racial justice, when it comes to social justice. And though Biden is talking about he is moderate, he's a centrist, and he's lining his cabinet picks with a diverse group of people, visually this all looks very good, and many of these people are very smart and they're very talented. However, we've seen it before where elected officials or appointed positions, people in appointed positions who are minorities, are also enveloped in systemic racism within the system. And when that happens, they become moderates too. And we are not in a place in America right now where moderation is necessarily the best idea.
Could you go a little further with that? I mean, I'm not sure. You know, I said that the one thing we can't do is disintegrate this very good coalition. Now, he's saying some great things. He's saying great things about science. He's saying great things about people coming into the country and reversing so much of what he's saying. And he's appointing a great cabinet. But I don't see that as stifling progressive ideas. Do you?
Well, he has to go further than just reversing what Trump did and going one step ahead of where we were. He needs to go farther than that. He needs to, in my opinion, treat this situation that he's come into where Trump and the administration has revived hatred and homophobia and xenophobia and all of these things. He has to not only reverse those, but go three steps forward in them to be progressively where we should be at. Because if we get caught up in just reversing what Trump did, then you're only putting us back into America where we were before Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, you know, George Floyd, and also the pandemic, where the issues in disparity with health care and all of those things economically as well are in place. So I'm hoping his picks, where he's picking people that really see the interlocking way systems work, are going to be, you know, progressive in going the three steps rather than the one step.
So could you give us some specifics? I mean, in other words, what's on your laundry list of things that not only reverse what Trump did, but you see as necessary to go forward?
Well, for example, Sarah was talking earlier about getting the vaccine, you know, and witnessing this thing and thinking about how Black and brown people have a distrust of the healthcare system. They also have less ability to access it. They also are financially, you know, worse off. And so there has to be a connection in climate change, in environmental justice in many cities, in developing good paying jobs and stakeholders in those communities that will also involve the reform of police, looking at funding education in those communities, as well as health care. Because that right there is really interlocking all of those systems across the country, and yes, predominantly in those hardest hit areas, which are urban centers and have Black and brown people to a large part, but also in rural centers where they are predominantly white and they are poor and they often vote against their best interests when it comes to health care and things. Biden needs to be able to, his cabinet needs to be able to create a unity in interlocking systems for both parties to be able to improve access to health care, jobs and investment, education in those, and it's and environmental help, creating jobs through maybe going green a little bit more, right? Those, they're hard and they're big questions, but they cannot separated any longer.
Fran?
I get the sense that that is his intention, but I think one of his big challenges, because I really agree with you on like all of those goals. And I think, you know, so you think about what are his strategies. And I think his challenge is figuring out, you know, when do you need to fix the system, evolution, and when do you need to replace the system, revolution. And, you know, in some of those cases, we need to basically replace the system because the system isn't working, or the system is too entrenched in bias, or the system, you know, it just doesn't serve our public interest needs. But in some of those cases, you know, it's a system that if we changed things about it, could be better. And so, you know, I think that's the challenge for him, because he can't just sort of take everything down, because then you don't have everything. And you can't just fix everything, because some of the things are really bad. And I think under the Trump administration, there were a lot of those systems that really got skewed to become weaponized in some sense and to become political when they weren't. You know, think about the CDC. The CDC is a bunch of medical professionals who are supposed to have the public interest in mind and have basically operated that way, you know, forever. And, you know, under this administration, the CDC became weaponized, it became marginalized, it became, you know, a tool of, you know, the administration for things that, you know, were towards their goals, not towards the public interest goals. So I think that's going to be tough for Biden. One thing that heartens me is I do think that the people that he's choosing show his commitment to inclusivity. I like that. And I think, you know, it will be on their shoulders to try to figure out how can they better the system or replace the system as needed, you know, to sort of meet the outcomes that we'd like from those goals. But I think it's going to be a long and messy process. I don't think, you know, there's sort of an easy fix and we can just swap out everything, you know, this week and then next week it gets better. I mean, I would hope that, you know, such things were possible, but I don't really think they are.
So we were within inches of losing Obamacare, right? Does everybody agree on that? You know, between the Supreme Court and... Now, the question is revolution or evolution? It's an interesting question. To me, the idea that Biden wants to put Obamacare back on a solid footing is a very progressive and incredibly important thing to do. But listening to the discussion, I'm not sure everybody agrees with me.
I've got a few thoughts on immigration. unless we're going to the next topic.
No, let me go to a break and catch that quick because I don't want to shorten your reply. So let me just take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go right to that. We have a wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. And Alan asked a very good question, and Sarah was ready to respond in regards to immigration. So I'll turn it right over to her.
So I think that we need to respond to the way that the Trump administration dismantled our justice system, particularly for immigrants, but across the board, with the same energy. And if we think about it in terms of restoring justice, it's not just putting things back to the way that they were. Like Jennifer said, now we know how much more broken it is than we thought it was even before Trump arrived. We have an opportunity to address what we see, as opposed to saying, oh no, like David Frum this weekend had an editorial, I think in The Atlantic, that said, or Politico, if the Biden immigration plans could wreck his whole administration from the start. That is completely a red herring, unhelpful language that comes from a place of fear. And I reject it, and I don't think it should drive this administration's policies. Just all of the... And you know, it is a lot of work, but we have a large government. The federal government is sprawling, and there are lots of good people that can sort of like repair the china that the bowl in the china shop broke, painstakingly, right? But that doesn't mean that we should take it incrementally because we're afraid we're going to lose votes. Restoring justice doesn't lose votes. And there are things that can be done on day one. I'm very excited about those things, but that will essentially put us, those are band-aids to a larger issue where we need to have judges that are not in the executive branch. Our immigration judges are in the executive branch. That needs to change. We need comprehensive immigration reform. That has to be done by Congress. That will involve coalition building. But we have Congress as a party. I agree with Alan to the extent that we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, but we can't get in the way of progress because we're afraid. That is the opposite. We have 4 years, and that is all we're guaranteed. And look what they did with their four.
Right.
We have a huge opportunity.
One of my favorite Fran Berman lines is that it is possible, and there are certain people who can walk and chew gum at the same time. Right? I mean, we can do multiple things, right?
Yeah. There's long-term, there's short-term, there's mid-term. We can do all of those things, and we can have really smart people working on all of those tracks. And some of them will work out, and some of them will get caught up. But the voice of the people has to be, you know, all gas, no brakes.
And we have no real idea of what Biden is going to do. We have no idea. His initial moves seem right to me. As long as the American people see, you got a 50-50 split in the United States Senate. We can't afford to blow that, because once you blow it, you got Mitch McConnell back in charge and not calling for votes and not letting the American people see, and the people in those Republican states see what their representatives are doing. No, I'm going to give him a chance before I start yelling at him. I think he has. I hear every word you're saying, and I hope you're right that this can be done, but it's got to be done carefully.
Libby, you were going to say?
Yeah, I think we need to look to the civil servants in the federal government who have had their hands tied for 4 years, who have worked assiduously before the Trump years to make life better, to do their jobs, to implement policy that is fair. And those folks now will have the muzzles taken off. I mean, there's a lot of those people in there who want to do the right thing. I think we'll also see in the first week, let alone the first 100 days, a flurry of executive orders around all kinds of issues, including abortion, and which is incredible.
We do. Hello? Something happened.
Hello.
I don't know. Libby, somehow, weirdly, you're calling me now. So We'll try to fix that. Okay. We have a bunch of letters. Let's get to those before the top of the hour. Gordon writes and says, if Trump is no longer president when he is tried in the Senate, who will pay for his defense? Is he responsible for his own legal costs? Will he be called to testify in the Senate? I have no idea. Sarah, do you have any idea on that?
No, I don't. But I'm sure. I'm sure there will be reporting on that.
Yeah,
Does anybody have to worry about poor Trump? I mean, he's collected, I think, $200 million by going back to his people, and he will continue to do that.
I think they're worried about us paying for it.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. Yeah. And I'm equally worried. This guy doesn't. There are a lot of people out there. Sarah knows all about this. Who have no resources at all, who are screwed to the wall because they can't afford a lawyer in the first place. And I'm not going to be worrying about him.
Amen.
Bill writes, happy Dr. King Day, something worth celebrating and in direct opposition to Trump's insurgency we saw in D.C. on January 6th. I take Alan's fear of Trump's dangerous potential seriously. How many criminal mob dons skip town when their minions are charged with creating mayhem in the town the boss just left? Of course, this godfather will always claim innocence on the basis of distance from the crime. Could Trump's exiting D.C. before Inauguration Day be a warning signal of bad things in store for D.C. while the Don hunkers down at Mar-a-Lago? I pray all of his farewell schemes, if any, are foiled safely.
I think this guy is going to be seen as a total miscreant by many, many people. I think his numbers are going to continue to go down now that he's out of power and that he's going to be held responsible for a lot of things. And I think that includes New York State and his violation of tax laws and the fact that Cyrus Vance is on to this guy and that a Secretary of State, our Attorney General in New York is after him. I think he's got a lot to worry about. And I think you can explain a great deal of what he was doing in his last days to his fear of all of that happening.
Let's see. Chris writes, with only about 50 hours left in his administration, I'm starting to think that Trump won't release his health plan.
That's a good one.
I'm with you, Chris.
Oren says, please remember that the Dems might lose the House or Senate in the next election. We have two years for reform, not four. I think, Alan, that was the point you were making.
It was.
Let's see. Levi says, love the show. With all due respect, advocating for the moderate agenda is a mistake. Moderates are not change, and moderates are part of the reason where we are today. People supported Trump because they are sick of politics as usual. Voters on both sides of the aisle do not want more of the same. Obamacare remains a wonderful vehicle to guarantee the sale of insurance. Single payer wasn't even negotiated during the development of Obamacare. This was the result of quote-unquote moderates doing the negotiations. It's time for progress, not more fear-mongering from the center.
I don't know if anything I said before got on the air.
It did, mostly, yes.
It did, okay, because I looked at my phone and I was on hold. So,
yeah, no, you called me weirdly. I don't know, but let's go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, yes, the moderates were in charge of Obamacare, but I just, you know, I want us to be as progressive as possible in the change that's going to happen in the next at least 2 years. But we have to recognize that if we want to hold on to the majorities in both houses, we have to also be able to play to Peoria. And the middle of this country is not the coasts, and their sensibilities are a lot different. And we just need to recognize that as we move forward. Because if we don't, we will lose. And that's my biggest fear.
And you'll be right back in the soup.
Yeah.
Have time for one more letter, and then we'll go to a break and news with Ray Graff. Susan writes, totally agree with the idea your panelist said of going further. I am so glad that people like Bernie Sanders and Marty Walsh will be there to push for reform, the type we had until the late 1970s. And this time, as good as Biden and his cabinet is, we have to be there to support these reforms. We have to do whatever we can as well and not expect it will happen in just 4 years. We'll pause there. We'll come back. We have much more to discuss with our terrific panel, Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us for this Monday morning. It is the 18th of January, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's talk about unity. The Republicans are calling for unity. They think we should be more united. Enough of the fighting. Now, they also are not ready to say that Joe Biden won the election, but they are looking for unity. And so what happened to this is a quote from Jim Jordan. What happened at the Capitol on January 6th was as wrong can be, he told colleagues during a virtual committee meeting about Democrats' demands that Trump be removed from office. Now is the time for healing. And in Jordan's opinion, that meant allowing the president to finish out his term. The committee chairman, Representative Jim McGovern, pressed him on that point. Hadn't Jordan and more than 140 other Republicans given oxygen to the false conspiracy theory pushed by Trump that motivated the Capitol rioters, that the election had somehow been stolen when they had voted to object to certifying the electoral results? We all want healing, but in order to get the healing, we need truth and we need accountability, McGovern said. So my question for you is, will you admit that Joe Biden won fair and square and the election was not rigged or stolen? McGovern's question was met with 17 seconds of silence before Jordan said that Biden would indeed be inaugurated president, a clear dodge of the question about the nature of Biden's victory. So as president-elect Biden prepares to be sworn into office, surrounded by more than 20,000 National Guard troops protecting the inauguration from one of the gravest domestic terrorism threats in U.S. history, Democrats and other Trump critics are pushing Republicans to renounce the party's embrace of the falsehood that inspired the Capitol attack and is motivating many of the Trump supporters vowing to take up arms again. So far, those efforts have been mostly fruitless. Even as much of corporate America threatens to withhold donations from lawmakers who objected to the election results and social media companies cancel accounts, including Trump's, spreading the false conspiracy theories, the bulk of elected Republicans continue to follow Trump's lead in refusing to acknowledge that Biden's win was legitimate and fair. Alan.
What are you going to say? First of all, McGovern is a hero. You know, I've been interviewing him on our Congressional Corner show for a long time now. And just like the late Maurice Hinchey and other great heroes, he refuses to knuckle under to nonsense. And this business of Jordan's is, you know, can't we all get together? Yeah, you had a president and you were the most divisive group of people ever. And now you want us to get together? It just stinks and smells to high hell of hypocrisy, and it is exactly that. What else is there to say?
Oh, Libby, how do you feel about Republican unity?
Well, they can be as united as they'd like, but really this is all about dodging responsibility for what happened at the Capitol last week. Oh, we should be united. It was horrible. Blah, 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 blah. Wink and a nod. If you want to do it again, go right ahead. And how many of those folks are complicit? How many members of the Republican conference in Congress, in the House of Representatives, are complicit in what happened? You know, you've got Boebert from Colorado tweeting out that Nancy Pelosi wasn't in her office and, you know, ostensibly other locations for other members. You've got Louis Gohmert, who's, you know, got the IQ of a gnat, you know, talking about what's legal and what's not. I mean, you know, they want unity as long as they get to define what that unity is. And that's not the way it works.
Well, Jennifer Burns, your thoughts.
I'm going to say this very nicely. It's bullcrap. That's what it is. Okay? It's, let's just move on, forget that it happened, nobody gets punished, and it's really a repeat of what the government in many states and at the federal level has said to people in America that are black and brown
and of Asian descent and in the LGBTQ community when for decades their homes and their bodies have been attacked by people and there has been no justice to it, right? When there have been, there has just been terrible hate crimes, busting in people's houses, sexually assaulting and murdering people, and the government, law enforcement, other people often for decades have looked the other way. That has had a generational impact on many people in this country. And for the Congress and the House members who were in there, they had one moment. For many of them, it was one moment of attack. And so for them, knowing they're going to go home, they're still going to have their power, they're still going to have their money, it's, I want to keep it. And you guys be quiet, and we'll continue the same pattern in America where we don't hold people accountable for their violence and the violation that they commit to the constitutional rights of other people. That's what they're repeating right now. And it's pathetic.
You know, Jennifer, you guys understand politics so much better than I do, all of you. And but I just keep thinking to myself, I'm just really mystified. When did reality become political? You know, maybe the same time that public health became political and, you know, truth became, you know, political. But, you know, it seems to me that every first grader knows that you don't win all the time. How come our politicians don't know that? I mean, I'm really mystified as to how things have taken this dramatic and extreme of a turn. I don't know. Please explain it to me. I don't get it.
It started with Kellyanne Conway and alternative facts. And then it went downhill from there.
Huh.
You know, they just have their own version of reality and they're going to stick to it regardless of the truth.
But, I mean, that's a fine place to start, I guess. But, I mean, it has to go back a lot further. And also the fact that you had a public that was willing to believe it.
Mm-hmm. It sure does. And I think we can unify around something that we all agree on, and that white nationalism is a domestic terror, and it takes domestic redress to get to it. And that implicates police reform, that implicates economic injustice, that implicates our healthcare system, it implicates what we're teaching our children in schools, it implicates the Voting Rights Act, which has been systematically dismantled by Republicans.
Yeah.
Sure, we can all get on the same page about restoring all of those things. Let's do it, you know? That should be our unity cause. If we can all but six, including Elise Stefanik, agree that what happened in Congress 2 weeks ago was anti-American and that we never want it to happen in our republic again, then let's unify around that. Let's get on the same page about that. And it just happens to be all of the talking points for the progressive agenda.
You know, I'm not sure you're right. I'm not sure you're right. I'll tell you why. Even the worst of these people, the Republican senators and Congress people, have said this wasn't right. Hey, they could have gotten killed. They know it. They say it, but what they can't agree on and what they won't agree on is that Trump was responsible.
That may be true, but what I'm saying is we shift from Trump's responsibility, because that will sort itself out, and focus on the issues underlying this, which Jennifer articulated, I think, really beautifully.
Right. I mean, they can all say, Alan, oh, this was the wrong thing to do, and then parrot this notion of unity because it's cover for them.
Absolutely.
Because I don't think they all think it was the wrong thing to do. I think people like Jim Jordan and Boebert and Gohmert and some of these other folks were like, saying, yeah, let's take back this place because it's rightfully ours. We're white. We are the ones who should be running the show. And I, you know, I think a lot of their hand-wringing was false. Was just false. It was just a good show so that they could look good in the news.
Sure.
And that was about it.
Sure, you're right, but it is not one or the other. You know, I'm sorry, no matter who on this panel, you know, doesn't think I'm right about this, everybody's entitled to their opinion, believe me. But Trump has to be held responsible for what he's done.
Absolutely.
And it isn't we all...
I don't think anybody disagrees with that.
Well, no. Except that I want to say we have to move on from Trump. because Trump was the worst possibility that this country has ever come up with for heading towards fascism and totalitarianism. No question. You look at Putin, you look at Duterte, you look at all these other guys. Those were his friends. That's what he wanted to do. So I do think that while we have to have a progressive agenda, and nobody's, I defer to nobody in terms of what I want, but I do think you have to do both. As you have said, Libby, I believe, you have to learn to chew and walk at the same time.
Walk and chew gum at the same time.
Yeah.
But we also have to, thing is that we can't not hold Trump accountable even as we want to move forward. He needs to go to jail.
I'm with that.
Period.
Well, and I think I want to add to this. We can walk, chew gum, and dribble a basketball at the same time. Right? There are quite a few things we can do. One, we really do need to hold people accountable by law in an equal fashion. And the Republican Party is unwilling to, most of them are unwilling to call a thing a thing. This president absolutely built this movement. These Republicans who are supporting him enjoyed it while it was benefiting them. And they are afraid those things are going to be taken away from them. And so they are going to support this man. They're going to try to unify or at least keep his base because they believe they're entitled to it.
Mm-hmm.
That is where they're headed.
Other people, it's all about entitlement.
Oh, well, too bad. It's always been that way. So that's how it is. Oh, well, what's different now? It's always been that way. And they're not saying that, but that's exactly how they're acting. And, you know, this is also comes out to are thinking about after the Civil War, right, during Reconstruction. That reconciliation that ended up happening was really because the North walked away and continued to have systemic racism. It was just not as blatant as the Jim Crow South. And so that resulted in, or culminated in, we'll say, a civil rights movement. And here we are again, because after the civil rights movement, the reconciliation went to a colorblind rhetoric.
Mm.
So it blinded people from seeing where you still had racism systemically, and you still had exacerbated racist, homophobic, xenophobic outcomes taking place. So we are here because when we did this unity and reconciliation in the past twice, it was not done well.
Anyone on that?
Well, I think there's plenty of people.
Go ahead, Fran. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying the thing, you know, when you step back and you look at it, you know, you have this incredible history that touches everyone, and that's a history of disenfranchisement. You know, where did Trump come from? Well, there's a bunch of people whose politics I don't agree with that felt disenfranchised. You know, during Trump's administration, there's a bunch of people, of which I'm one, who felt disenfranchised. And, you know, I think, and I, you know, I'm not suggesting that the only solution here, which I don't believe is completely realistic, is the kinder, gentler solution. But I do think we need to deal with disenfranchisement in our community by all groups. And, you know, to me, the loss of tolerance, the loss of the ability to have a civilized discourse on things, the loss of being able to work together when your side isn't winning, and the diminishment of all of that, you know, creates an environment that's really infertile soil for doing anything but getting your side to win and then just, like, you know, knocking the other people over the head with, you know, whatever you think is right. And having had my head knocked, you know, for the last, you know, I don't know how many years, that doesn't feel good. And I think the challenge for Biden, and I really don't have any suggestions for how he might do it, but I think it's an important thing to think about, is, you know, how do you bring those folks who are currently now going to be disenfranchised along? Right. How can you change their minds? How can you, I don't know how to do that, you know, how can you, you know, bring them forward so, you know, unity, which is now everybody's favorite buzzword, and, you know, it's fine buzzword by me, you know, how do you actually get there? You know, it's very well and good to say, you know, we want unity, but what does that actually mean? And how do you actually get there? And how do you actually include people who don't think exactly like you? I really worry about that, and I don't know the answers to that.
Libby?
Well, you know, the people who felt disenfranchised before Trump and then felt empowered during Trump, you know, what they're afraid of is no longer having white privilege, and that they will no longer, white people will no longer be in the majority, because as I have said for the last 4 years, this always comes down to race. It really does. It all comes down to race. And so, you know, it's about folks recognizing what white privilege means, and the fact that unless there's whole-scale economic redistribution of wealth, white people may not be in the majority, but economically, we will always be in the majority because of the way the structure works and because of how poverty just breeds poverty and our policies don't really lift people out of poverty. And the notion of bootstrapping and the American dream is just not, it's a gold ring that many, many people can never really grab. And there are plenty of white people who can't grab it either, but they blame black people. They don't blame, and people of color, they don't blame the system, you know, or they blame socialists. So they'll blame Joe Biden, you know. So we have to recognize that white privilege plays a really big role in all of this. And some of these folks will never be enfranchised, as it were, if the Democrats maintain their majority. My hope is that the Department of Justice does its job, the FBI does its job, and they start rooting out these domestic terrorists, because that's what they are. The KKK is domestic terrorism. White supremacism is domestic terrorism. You know, the people who are at the all the capitals, the folks that did the insurrection 2 weeks ago, they're all domestic terrorists, and that's the dividing line, really, for me. They need to be put in jail. They need to be stopped, because otherwise our democracy will not survive. We will go through 4 years of Biden, and then some other demagogue like a Josh Hawley will get elected, and then we're back to square one.
Alan?
Well, you know, I keep thinking of Martin Luther King when we start talking about who's been disenfranchised in this country. He certainly knew it. And he did not only speak of black deprivation, he spoke of human deprivation. He talked about what happened. And you are so on target when you talk, when you point to the way this was to the way this appeal is made to people who without ultimate resources, whose frustration turns to hatred of people who are not like themselves. Very, very scary. And it's appropriate to think of that on ML King Day.
Absolutely. All right. We have.
And I think, you know.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, please do. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I keep coming back to the debate between Kamala Harris and Mike Pence. And one of the things Kamala Harris said, but she looked into the camera and she said to people, if you vote for Trump, remember, they're coming for you. And of course, what? I think what she meant was if you reelect him, right, that the people that are supporting him are going to wreak havoc. But also, even if he didn't win, right, if you're a supporter of his and you're voting for him, then eventually this mob that's supporting him are going to turn on you, too. Because it's so filled with hate and because our system does not hold people accountable in an equal way. And so that's what we're seeing now. People are coming for you.
All we need to do is look at what those insurrectionists did to the police that day, last Wednesday. They were beating up the police. These are law and order folks. These are people who stand locally with their police departments. But they were beating up and they killed police officers. I mean, and the police unions haven't said a word because they all backed Trump. So you want to talk about coming for each other. This is the perfect example of how these insurrectionists, these domestic terrorists who say they're for law and order can't even abide by the basic principles of protecting the Capitol and policing. And they went after the police. It's just mind-boggling.
Not surprisingly, we have a lot of letters, so let me get to as many as we can before our bottom of the hour break. Anna says, unity does not mean freedom from justice. Justice first and unity follows.
I like it.
David writes, esteemed panel, I consider myself a progressive, but I feel the we know what's good for you and you're going to like it vibe that we often give off turns people off who might be convinced that reform is actually in their best interest. Rob writes, the only reason that all Republicans, quote unquote, believe the assault on our Capitol was, quote unquote, wrong is because it was unsuccessful. Armin says the Republican.
That's really great.
Yeah.
That's a great letter. It really is, because we still haven't decided what he had, what Trump had in mind with all of this. Did he really think that, that those people would come in and take over the Capitol and he'd end up the president again? Now, we all say, nah, he couldn't have, but maybe he could.
Well, and there were elements of it that were successful. I mean, it was looked to be a terrorist act, and it was. So I understand the point, of course, that there could have been much, much more, but certainly damage was done. Armin writes, the Republican unity rhetoric reminds me of thoughts and prayers after mass shootings to avoid discussion of action and responsibility. Oliver says the remaining Trump enablers offer a bizarre anti-impeachment argument. Impeachment would divide the country. By the same broken reasoning, if a father fails in his attempt to murder his wife, he shouldn't be prosecuted because it would divide his family. This qualifies as the defense's advocate is insane defense.
Chutzpah. The idea that, you know, you kill your parents and then you say throw yourself on the mercy of the court because of you're an orphan is exactly the same point.
Joan writes, I believe that you are not looking enough at the power of the religious right within the GOP. Disenfranchisement predates Trump. He just added white privilege to the mix. It started rearing its ugly head with Sarah Palin. Kamar says white supremacy is not only upheld by poor white folk, their votes matter, yes. Do not fall prey to that same exact mistake we have made since Reconstruction, blaming only poor white folk. Bob says Trump was elected by the Electoral College in 2016, not the public. The Electoral College was the justification for the mob. Get rid of it. Kathy says unity is overrated. Diversity is the source of all creativity and societal strength. That's how natural evolution works. Democracy works not by suppressing diversity, but by providing means by which it can be channeled into constructive action.
Yeah, but those are two different things. I mean, unity has to do with how you work together, and diversity has to do with who's at the table. I don't see those as the same.
Terry writes,
yeah, but, by the way,
go ahead.
You
can't really have unity without diversity. I think that's the point.
And I want to say that anti-black efforts and racism didn't start with Sarah Palin, believe me. You got Ronald Reagan and welfare cheats and all the rest of it.
Terry writes, what the Republicans are doing now by calling for unity and saying that if Democrats hold people accountable, it's going to keep us from being able to unify is exactly what narcissists do in an abusive relationship. They take what you've said and they twist it around and make themselves the victim and make you the perpetrator.
Very profound.
We go to Kathleen. How many of the lawmakers who refused to walk through metal detectors last week left weapons in their offices? Good question. We go to Joanne, who says, before a wound heals, the infection needs to be neutralized. That in regards to the Republican call for unity. We have this letter, which asks a question, which I will hold because we don't have time for the answer. So we'll pause there for a moment. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss in our last go-round with our wonderful panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue into our last go-round right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah
Rogerson. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Just go to a few of these, and then we'll move on to our final subject for this morning in our last few minutes together. Howard writes, further to the letter about deaths from COVID, I think the point is that some number of people would have died if we had had another president. Can't be responsible for all 400,000 deaths. Beyond that, every Western country has failed adequately to control the virus. Many Asian countries have reduced the impact substantially, but even they have had death. On the issue of moderates, Bob writes, Biden is going to move us in all of those progressive directions, but don't start undercutting moderates. You need everyone. And we go to Cheryl, who says, Libby, Peoria has a responsibility to get woke to more liberal ideas. Did you mention Peoria? I didn't catch that you had mentioned Peoria. I don't know.
She did.
Okay, she did. Okay.
She did.
All right.
But immigration polls well in Peoria, too. Just, you know, like we have to remember that, like, there are things.
Immigration does pull well. Yeah.
Yeah. So we just, you know, we've got a lot of strategy to do in the Democratic Party.
What doesn't pull well is defund the police. That does not pull well in the middle of the country. There are things that do not pull well. So we just have to, and I get it. I understand. Yes, Peorians and the people in the middle of the country need to wake up and broaden their political horizons. But we also have to recognize the limits of that as we go through the next 2 to 4 years.
All right. Let's go to some other topics here. And there we go. So we started off by talking about, Fran was very excited because science is back. So there is an article in the Times today about Biden elevating science advisor to his cabinet. The president-elect is nominating Eric Lander to head the Office of Science and Technology Policy, a post left vacant by President Trump for 18 months. So in some sense, of course, that is that's what you mean by science coming back, Fran, but in many other quarters as well. But Biden announced on Friday that he will elevate that to refresh and reinvigorate our national science and technology strategy. What do you know about Eric Lander?
He is great. I think Biden made a really inspired choice with him. He has the scientific creds, to be sure. He's led the Broad Institute. He's a mathematician and a geneticist. He was one of the two groups that raced to the finish line in mapping the human genome. And since then, the Broad Institute has been great, but he also has a really sort of broad perspective. You can't just sort of sit in science land and, you know, not think about all of the economic and the political and the other kinds of, you know, cultural repercussions of what you do. And he's really great for that. And he is, what Trump did is he made the Office of Science Technology policy. He made Kelvin Drogemeyer, who's, you know, a stand-up guy and a real scientist, but he was very much marginalized. He was the head of OSTP. He was not science advisor. Lander is science advisor, and he's elevated it, as I think Libby said, to, or someone else said, to the cabinet, which is the first time ever. The rest of the team includes Alondra Nelson, an incredibly well-known social scientist, as deputy director of OSTP, a very important position. And then PCAST, the Presidential Committee on, you know, Science and Technology, which was, you know, fallow for most of Trump's administration and then had hardly any scientists on it, are going to be co-led by Frances Arnold and Maria Zuber, a chemical engineer and roboticists and scientists. John Kerry is going to head up climate, Office of Climate Change. And, you know, all of these folks are really amazing. And I watched the C-SPAN version of his introduction of them, and he and Kamala Harris were, like, positively giddy about it. I wanted to say one thing, and I don't want to use up too much of the time, but Biden has already sent Lander a letter about the science priorities. for the next 4 years. So let me tell you what they are, just in case you're wondering what they should be. One of them is the pandemic and public health. What can we learn from the pandemic to improve public health? Another one is climate change, which was important for the Biden administration. What are science and technology solutions to that, including economic repercussions and all of that? Number three is, how can we be a world leader in tech? And this takes on our competition with China and other countries. Number four is, how can we share the fruits of science? So that goes at eliminating the digital divide and other kinds of divides, which means that, you know, some people get the fruits of science and some people don't so much. And the last one is, how can we be sure of the health of the science and technology community in the U.S., because we have really been withering under the last administration and even under, you know, the economic problems of, you know, 2009 and beyond. So so it's a pretty ambitious agenda. It's exactly right. And I think any progress we make on any of these problems will be really wonderful.
Good, Fran, perhaps you can help me with one fast thing, and that is,
sure.
Trump obviously hated science. I think some of it is clear. You know, abortion, things of that kind, which he felt melded into his natural support group. But is there anything in particular that you can point to that that made Trump so asthmatic to science?
You know, I don't think it was just science, Alan. I think that, you know, I mean, in my opinion, not a medical professional, you know, he's a narcissist. And, you know, anything that stands in the way of him getting what he wants done, and I couldn't even pretend to try to imagine his thought processes, was, you know, like the bad guy. And I think, you know, science was one of them. I mean, he really, in my opinion, again, didn't really want to think about the pandemic. You know, it's like, it's not, you know, he couldn't make money off it. He couldn't, you know, he couldn't control it. He just didn't want to be bothered by it. And science isn't always right, as we all know. I mean, science is a bunch of really smart people trying to solve a problem that's unknown and, you know, doing sort of a well-evidenced approach that tries to get at a solution. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And science builds on all of those attempts in a really well-structured, well-disciplined way when done ideally right. But, you know, this doesn't fit in my own impression of Trump's worldview. So I don't think science was so special, but I definitely think it was a target.
But, you know, it's so interesting because he is, Trump is a guy who obviously is playing to a particular, what he sees as a particular class of people. Are we agreed on that?
And these are people that respond to, I remember this old commercial. Do you remember this, Alan? And everyone else, it was like, you know, some guy comes on TV and I forget what drug it was, but it says, you know, I don't care what the scientists say. I take this drug. It just makes me feel better. Well, right. You know, I bet cocaine makes you feel better too, or heroin. But, you know, it's like, why is that, you know, an argument to do something that you don't know whether it's good or bad for you? So yeah. I just think that's kind of his thinking.
You know, you can
be affluent and be skeptical of science. Like, you know, I pushed back on that. We had CEOs of major multinational corporations involved in this mob attack. We had affluent white blonde real estate agents and internet personalities. This idea that Trump was only pandering, it's actually the most dangerous contingent in his cohort. The people that he relies on are wealthy, white, college-educated people. They just grasp on to this, you know, skepticism of science and this embracing of the new evangelical notion of really what is white nationalism wrapped up in the Bible, in pages of the Bible. And that's all
right.
That it is. And they drink from that well, and they support him with their dollars.
Well, that's right, but you have to look at it two ways. One is, you're absolutely right. Those people with the money are a real constituency, Trump constituency. But on the other hand, the other folks, the people who hate the educated, who think it's a dual class system where people who went to college are better than they are or think they're better than they are. So he plays to both of them. I don't think it's either or.
Well, no, and sometimes
the QAnon people are a perfect example of that. They don't want to deal with fact or science because that would get in the way of their conspiracy theories.
Sarah?
Just that simple.
Yeah, there are lots of self-made people in this country who are doing really well or are solidly middle class to the extent that exists anymore, or who see themselves as doing well, who still embrace that ideology because they didn't go to college and they still made it in America. It's like really a true tragedy of the great American story is that people in those situations, and there's a lot of them, would also turn against science and education and not see the value of it. That's a much bigger conversation.
Also, there's long run and a short run. Short run, we have to find a way out of this COVID crisis. It's terrible. People are dying. 500,000 people are going to be dead. We are now told. And yet climate change, which is going to blow up the earth, no question about it, we say, that's for the future. So I think that's one of the big differences between our emergencies. The climate emergency is huge. It's real. Nevertheless, you can't convince people of it.
Mm.
You know, why wouldn't we be proud of the best and the brightest in the U.S.? You know, I'm proud of Beyonce. I'm proud of, you know, sports figures. I'm proud of Eric Lander and Alondra Nelson. It's like, you know, all of these people, you know, are at the top of the field. Does it mean they're always perfect? Does it mean that, you know, everything Beyonce ever will release again will be, you know, an absolute hit? You know, no. But, you know, it means that we're really proud of their achievements, and they're folded into the fabric of our community. And science is particularly important because it's helping us with new inventions. It's helping us with new strategies towards, you know, really scary problems. It won't always be perfect, but, you know, it's one of the best tools, if not the best tool we have. And so for Biden to kind of elevate that again, and to say, you know, this is a point of view that needs to be in the White House at the topmost levels. It's a point of view that needs to drive the way we think about solving these problems. You know, to me, that's like a miracle. And I'm incredibly excited about it. I don't think it's going to like all go without a hitch, but I think I'm really excited about it.
We are just about out of time, and I just want to say the only thing we didn't get to this morning was pardons, but so we're all on pardon watch for the next few hours. We'll see what happens over the remaining day and a half here of what horribleness there is to report, but we'll it would have been fun to speculate, but maybe we can do that tomorrow as well. My thanks to everybody this morning. We thank you for your letters. They were very helpful as well. Alan, thank you very much. Libby Post, Fran Berman, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson, I thank you all for being with us this morning. A great panel, and I so appreciate your participation. Thank you. Coming up next.
Happy MLK Day.
Thank you, Fran. Take care. Thank you very much. Coming up next, it is a Congressional Corner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.